Jay Guru. Welcome to the next episode of the podcast Awake, the Life of Yogananda, Minute by Minute. Today, we have reached minute number 46. But before we're going to go into the minute, we also have a special guest today. Marcus is joining us from Germany. Hello, Marcus. How are you doing?
Hi, everyone. I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Nice.
Very, very good. Thank you.
So usually when we have guests on, our first question is always like, how did they meet Guruji? How did they get on the path? What is your story there, Marcus?
So I was in Argentina, actually, some 10 years ago. And I was looking into meditation paths and different currents of mysticism. And at some point I found the Book of Master and I was magically drawn to it. And then I went to the center there, the local center, and it just felt like home, coming home, just felt so right. So I was having still a lot of doubts, but I kept asking God also to show me the right path, and the same answer kept coming back. So after, it took some time, probably 2 or 3 years, but after that I was really sure that this is my path.
Nice. It's so great that Guruji is like international everywhere. You meet him in Argentina and now you live in Germany, so you took him back there with you, and I'm sure you have a nice group there as well where you live. And
absolutely,
very nice. And then the movie Awake, when that came out, Did you see it right away? And what was the kind of feeling that it left you with after you watched it the first time?
Yeah, really, I was really curious to watch it. And I was probably one of the first people who watched it. And it was just so wonderful to see that some directors took the effort to make a movie about Master and put so much thought into understanding also the spiritual path, not just a biography. So watching the movie really was very special for me also, because I could see aspects of Master's life that I wasn't aware of so far. It just, you don't realize the struggles that Master went through in his lifetime, the very human struggles that we all go through. So that the movie really showed me that perspective.
Now that makes sense. I feel like we all felt like that for once. For me, it felt like the first time Guruji's story was told by a third person. And like you said, the struggles that we will get into this minute, by the way. So how did this make you feel when you saw also this kind of things that went wrong during Guruji's lifetime and those negativity that was brought onto him by a lot from the outside, from the press and those kind of things?
So I felt that I could even relate more to Guru, because he went through the same or even harsher struggles than we do. So he was not, he didn't just come here and had a saintly life and everything was beautiful and easy, but he had to struggle a lot, and people misunderstood him and gave so much goodness and worthy teachings, positive ways of living, and still people chose to not understand him right. So it made me just feel more connected.
Nice. Yeah, you're totally, I think, spot on that Guruji kind of, he never mentioned all the difficult things he went through. If you read the autobiography, he was there, he was in America during the Great Depression. He doesn't even mention it once, and World War II and all those kind of things. And yeah, so today in minute 46, it is about, they talk about Dhirananda and how he was causing an incident at Mother Center, and it erupted into a brawl. And then later on, there was a smear campaign against Yogananda and his organization. in the media, and he had to face it. He was at the time in Miami, and he had a lot of people who would chime in, and there were, I'm sure there were all kinds of motives against him. A lot of it, I would say, was also xenophobia. And let's start with the actual incident. And I think Priyank is going to guide us through that part.
Yes. I'm mainly using the account as given by Phil Goldberg in his biography, in Guruji's biography. So he did quite a lot of research into this incident, and it's quite interesting, some of which is quite amusing. Probably wasn't that amusing at the time, but we can look at it now 100 years on with a bit of amusement, I suppose. We have to laugh at some parts of this Maya world, otherwise we'll only cry, I suppose. So apparently, the incident itself took place in 1926. But these newspaper headlines that you see in all this minute, i.e., you know, the sex cult and all that kind of stuff, actually only appeared in like 1928. So there was 2 years worth of non-disclosure. So let's read what happened. And apparently let's add some poetic license to it, because obviously newspapers have a very good way of making things, romanticizing certain stories or certain parts of the story and making it more grand. Phil Goldberg describes it as breathless prose that was used in The Buffalo. And Marcus is going to read it out.
Okay.
The incident. So this is the incident itself in as described in this either newspaper or, I don't know, it's called The Buffalo.
The Buffalo.
Yeah.
So here's what happens, according to The Buffalo. The dark room, redolent of the exotic scent of the lotus flower, through the swirls of incense, glows the faint spark of a ruby lamp, illuminating the countenance of a swami, clad in a flaming robe. Seated on his lacquered throne, he is murmuring in a musical drone the sacred mysteries of the Kundalini, the all-powerful power discovered by Hindu mystics after centuries of self-mortification, prayer, and meditation. Men and women who a few moments before stepped from luxurious equipages outside the temple gates and who represent the very cream of aristocracy and wealth, dressed in the ceremonial robes of yoga, are sitting cross-legged on the floor in their bare feet. They are drinking in every word, every nuance of the master's voice, for he is guiding them in attaining a power that will assure lasting youth. It is a scene of profound mysticism, but in the moment it is changed to one in which pandemonium reigns.
And this is when, this is when apparently the irate, angry husband of one of those people in that room, in that quite beautifully described environment, you'd want to go there yourself, I'm sure, someone comes in and thumps poor Swami Dhirananda on the nose. So no doubt he was leading some sort of meditation exercise, which is described beautifully in this article here. And what actually happened was, then obviously Dhirananda and Yogananda were talking about this incident, and it was essentially a misunderstanding. But the person that who came and punched him in the face was someone called Percy Rogers, who had discovered Yogananda during one of the early visits to New York. He attained the benefit of Yogananda's teachings and moved cross country to work for him. So this is a very serious devotee, you might say. But he may have become disillusioned or been influenced by his father, who was part of the Theosophical Society, etc., etc. But whatever, so that was him. And then his wife was obviously in the class. So something must have happened in their relationship, and Dhirananda was accused, or, you know, he may have, he gave her some sort of counsel or whatever that made this person angry. But what actually, well, the reason it was made into such a big thing is because the conversation between Dhirananda and Yogananda and, you know, this Percy Rogers and some others were recorded over a phone call by one of the secretaries at the center, and then that person, the secretary, and this Percy Rogers and others, I think Mrs. Scott was apparently the person, who was like a secretary on the East West magazine. She wiretapped the conversation and she was like, "Oh, I'm going to release parts of it, and it's going to, you know, make it look crazy." So Guruji was in, you know, in the south and trying to stop this from, you know, being seen as this crazy incident. It's just trying to contain it. So the legal stuff was going on, you know, assault and other, you know, other charges and discrimination and all those kind of stuff. But Guruji was trying to contain it, and there was a legal battle going on, and there was settlements, and so that is kept under wraps basically. And in the court case, whilst it was going, as it was described later on, Dhirananda was cleared of all charges, so it was a misunderstanding. So there was a settlement, a non-disclosure settlement. So this Mrs. Scott got her money or whatever to not let it out. But after 2 years, for whatever reason, it came out anyway. And newspapers made it into this colossal thing about Kundalini and sex force and making it an absolutely insane thing, as tabloid newspapers do back then to sell newspapers. That's quite a long-winded answer, but I think it's important that we get the context of what happened. Yeah, go on, Chris.
Yeah, whenever I first heard about this, my reaction was not one of surprise. Yeah, I was actually thinking that I was surprised to hear about that there weren't, there wasn't more of a severe backlash in this kind of a way, and more of a hard time given to the SRF organization at that time, because of the way that people were thinking at the time and their lack of knowledge or information about the subject. So in a sense, it's like, as Marcus said, you can relate to, you know, some of these worldly problems, and, you know, makes Master all that more relatable and inspiring because he pushed through really hard times. But I'm surprised there wasn't more of a backlash from the societies at that time in those places. That was my initial take on it. I wasn't surprised at all. At the same time, I was a bit more surprised there wasn't actually more coming out.
And for me, I kind of feel like this is how it often is when somebody new, unknown, comes into your sphere, and you he was like such a successful speaker, Guruji. But then when those stories broke, I can see that a lot of people kind of jumped on those stories, right? And were like, "I knew it," and all those kind of things, because I feel like this is what often happens when you don't know about something, and when you don't know about a whole culture and everything, then people tell you that it's bad. You just believe it easily, because I feel like this is kind of where a lot of xenophobia is born from. Anyways, should we move to the aftermath? So basically, like Priyank said, Guruji, when this broke, I think I remember this correctly, right? So when the story broke, Guruji was actually in Miami, right, in a hotel there, and then there was an angry mob outside, and this was probably unexpected for him. Like you said, this happened 2 years later, but this is now when the story actually became nationwide. And people were had the feeling that they need to be upset now. And Phil Goldberg describes this really nicely in his book. So we're gonna just read a section through this, how Guruji was in the motel in Miami and how he reacted. Chris, do you wanna read the first section?
Yes, I can do. So while Yogananda was, no doubt, keeping abreast of developments in LA, the start of his scheduled two weeks at Miami's Scottish Rite Temple drew healthy crowds. Then on February the 3rd, the Miami Daily News reported that the love cult exponent, in quotation marks, had been told to leave the city. And again, in quotation marks, "I'm ordering you out of town to satisfy a horde of protests against your activities," close quotation marks, Police Chief Leslie Quigg told Yogananda, "and to save you from a repetition of what happened to you in Los Angeles when the irate husband handed you one on the nose," close quotation marks. Never mind that the nose belonged to Dhirananda, on that, or that a telegram from James McLachlan corrected the mistaken identity at a hearing. The language makes it clear that the reports from LA had influenced not only city officials, but Miamians who wanted the Swami and his entourage gone. About 200 women had been taking Yogananda's classes. There was no mention of men in news reports. And some of their husbands were up in arms. That's from Philip Goldberg's The Life of Yogananda book.
Yeah,
everyone loves a scandal, don't they? So people even that had no interest in self-realization fellowship, yoga, Yogananda, India, they would have jumped all over this and just like... So newspapers that had probably never previously reported anything on yoga now jumping over this kind of thing just because it's going to sell. It's going to sell. And in a way, Guruji was a victim of his own success because he traveled around the country, like probably for the first, you know, introducing yoga for the first time to a lot of these people in America. And then this is like gold dust. This kind of stuff is gold dust, isn't it, for them? Because everyone would have been awed, you know, in awe by what Guruji had given them, and then this is just gold dust for newspapers.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it was already said that it was not even him, it was Dhirananda, and also he was not guilty, and still the story flew, right?
Yeah.
Chris?
I have to eat my earlier words a little bit. Because this is the great thing about doing this podcast is that we're kind of digging in a little bit more into the story of Yogananda's life, where I'm maybe others listening haven't been able to dig into or didn't dig into that maybe Yogananda had a much tougher time than what was realized or what simply he discussed himself. And I think that's the point that I want to raise, is that Yogananda often really focused on positives, right, and didn't want to dwell too much on any kind of negatively minded thinking. So he really had that iron will, and maybe that's probably where he thought, actually, you know, these things occur as to what Priyank said is probably true, for various reasons out of my control. I'm going to focus on what I do best, and that's what he did. So I'll eat my words slightly.
Which words did you eating?
I said I was. When I first heard about these issues, you know, and I can't remember where it was that I first heard it, I wasn't surprised, but at the same time I was surprised because I didn't hear many more issues.
Okay.
So I probably, you know, in tongue in cheek a little bit, in my words, because you know, it was simply that Yogananda didn't really dwell on it all that much.
Marcus?
So yeah, I was just thinking that, yes, people love scandals, right? It's easy to kind of have a discussion topic with your pals or your neighbor. But also these husbands, they took action, and maybe some of them didn't even know Master, and they just wanted to take action against something they didn't understand. And the thought came to me that it's like this phenomenon of projection that we sometimes like to direct our emotions, sometimes negative emotions, towards things that somebody represents to us. And probably these people they found the perfect image of projection in Master, this exotic Hindu with a turban and a yellow orange robe, apparently having this strange cult and attracting women to Hunaswar. So it's like the perfect space of projection. Also, if I think about it, like the 20s, probably was the 20s. I mean, in Germany, for example, that was like a completely different time. I don't even think that the German society would have been open to a Swami at all. So, but in the time that was before the Second World War, after the First World War, it's quite kind of understandable that people were estranged maybe by somebody who so looked and was so unusual, apparently.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I feel like Yogananda really consciously chose to go to where he went, to California, because he was looking for the West, but also a part of the West that was actually open to his teachings. And we talked about this in earlier episodes, that he was, when he started out in Boston, he found a society that was much more closed-minded and much more materialistic. And I'm sure that also played a role. And like Priyank said, he became a nationwide celebrity now. So now it was, all bets were off once the scandal came out. Chris?
Yeah, just listening to Marcus there made me reflect a little bit on the context again, and the fact that there were many women turning up to, you know, Yogananda's talks. And we've mentioned it before, there's pictures, you know, with auditoriums and rooms filled, and by and large it is women, it's a huge percentage. I don't really have a rationale as to why maybe that is, but, you know, that was over 100 years ago, and women's rights and their, you know, how they were integrated into activities in society, it was very, very different to how it is today. So, you know, it just reminds me, actually thinking about it, of there's a picture of like a woman doing a marathon run, and her husband, I think, is like defending her against like one of the organizers who's like desperately trying to like, you know, tackle her to stop her from completing the marathon. Have you seen this?
In
the,
no.
It's a great picture, yeah. It's a great picture. So there's a guy like properly like, it's like an American football scene. You know, the woman's like trying to finish this marathon, and there's somebody trying to stop her, and the outrage on the face. So it's, I don't know, there's maybe some kind of sexism coming in here where, you know, there's roles like that in society that we're bucking that trend in a good way, that maybe had something to do with the incident and so on. But it is interesting to think back. Of course, we can't know it for a fact, but we can certainly speculate, which is always fun.
Yeah, that makes sense. This picture that you painted of women's rights were different at the time. Also, when you read some of those headlines like "Love Cult Lures Many Women," it kind of takes away the self-responsibility of a woman, right? Like, they can do what they want, right? But back in the day, maybe men were seeing them more as like their property or something like that. And that was maybe also a problem, that the kind of patriarchal society was still much stronger than today, right?
Yeah.
Even just like the defensive, my thinking was more around like the role of the defender. You know, like life in the 19th century was tough, you know, it was hard. And beyond that, you know, it's really taken a good turn in the industrial age. But I think, so, you know, not to go too hard on men, to be up on men in some sense, because the role of the protector was needed for many, for a long time, you know, for good reasons. Typically against other men, obviously. but beside the point. But I agree with your points there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mike, you raised a good point about the whole luring side of it, because like part of the allegations were like, you know, the whole sex thing, right? Sex control and all that kind of stuff, or like luring people through that type of energy. But because part of what Guruji would have talked about and what Dhirananda did talk about was the Kundalini, the force in the spine, and not misusing your sex impulses, but actually withdrawing them and using that energy for higher purposes, as Guruji says, you know, taking that energy and bringing it up higher to the higher chakras so we can meditate better. So then what would have happened, perhaps, is the wife of this this person who got irate, she might have said, for example, this is a hypothesis, you know, this, I'm just hypothesizing, she might have said to her husband, let's have some restraint, you know, let's try not doing it as often as we do, let's, you know, let's focus on meditating, for example, and then he would have been like, who the hell is telling you this? And then she would have been like, oh, I learned it in Swami Dhirananda, he said a really nice thing about the Kundalini, about, you know, controlling your sex force. And then she would have, and then he would have been like, you can just imagine how this argument would go, right? And then him getting crazy jealous or whatever impulses he had, and him going there. And then he may have even walked in on him with a class of women. And then he's like going absolutely ballistic because of all this, you know, all this math that isn't really adding up in his narrow view of the world, even though he was following Yogananda for a while.
That's a really good point. I can imagine with some people that wasn't a popular message.
No, but even like I tell like some people at work, like about self, you know, self-restraint and how it's actually beneficial, not even talk about meditation, just like energy, yeah. You know, energy levels and, you know, where you put your mind and your focus, and but then they just don't, it's quite advanced thinking, even putting aside the meditation thing, that it makes sense from a biology perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, it also makes it interesting that like what Chris said earlier, that a lot of his followers were female, right? So I was wondering, why wouldn't they go there as a couple, for example? Like, don't know. We'll figure it out one day, maybe. Marcus?
I just wanted to add to that point that also the Kundalini is often depicted as a serpent, right? So if in this time also where society was mostly Christian, I believe even in the west of the US, then the serpent is still the picture of deception and of seduction, right? The beginning of all the evil. So basically what they're saying with this article is that there's this Oriental sitting on this lacquered throne, which already sounds shady, and he's showing them how to use the serpent energy. That sounds pretty demonic, diabolic.
It's very good interpretation. Yeah, very good. I feel like that the whole concept of the Kundalini is something that people are only slowly understanding now, right? That's when Guruji came, I guess he was one of the first people who taught yoga in this kind of big context in the West. And he probably came to an audience that was like, Kundalini, what is that? What? There's energy in my body. That was probably a very difficult first class for a lot of people. Should we continue in the chain of events there? I'm going to read the next section from Phil Goldberg, continuing from earlier. And it goes, variations of the Miami articles appeared in newspapers and disparate and dispersed as the New York Times and the Ogden Standard Examiner. Time magazine even took a swipe at Oprah star Amelita Galli-Curci for endorsing a man who looks like a plump woman. Wow. And had been offered by the police to leave, has been ordered by the police to leave Miami. Yogananda was not inclined to obey the edict. As we've seen, he was not easily cowed. His life threatened by a delegation of indignant citizens. Swami Yogananda, East Indian love cult leader, was at a hotel tonight, determined to stay in Miami and fight it out, one reporter wrote. He got himself a lawyer, Redmond B. Gauthier, who petitioned a federal court for an injunction against police interference with Yogananda's activities. He argued that if the police really wanted to protect the Swami from an angry mob, as they claimed, they should deal with the people making threats, not with the one being threatened. The court rejected his petition. Gauthier refiled in state court. Meanwhile, Chief Quick said that if Yogananda showed up for his next scheduled lecture, he'd have to finish his speech in jail. Wow. As a precautionary measure, a riot squad with tear gas canisters lined up outside the lecture site, the Anglers Club. And I'm guessing that was the venue where Gurji was going to speak. And like two things. One thing, it's great that like Yogananda, he has those kind of this adversity coming on to him, but he does not bow to it, right? He says, those are false allegations, which we even know that they are. It's just a newspaper hype, basically. And so he takes a lawyer, and the lawyer tries to get an injunction, and also the police. Like, it's really hard to understand how the police acts, right? Because they are supposed to defend the people who are in need of defense, right? And they tell him to leave because there is an angry mob outside the door. So much to civilization. We can continue. Priyank, do you want to read the next part?
Yeah, sure. Yogananda cancelled the talk and moved to an undisclosed location. The series of events was so sensational that Miami newspapers ran major stories almost daily, and Yogananda supporters and opponents filled City Hall for their hearings. To its credit, the Miami Daily News gave Yogananda space to write his own response to the charges against him. He seized the opportunity with two columns of emphatic prose, correcting newspaper errors, describing the nature of his mission, outlining his accomplishments, naming some of his eminent supporters, and expressing indignation mixed with irony. And he quotes, "I teach the formation of character and the highest moral teachings in self-discipline, both to married and unmarried people. And in return, I get the name of the leader of a love cult. And this, in spite of the fact that there is not the slightest foundation for it." He suggests that if he'd wanted to start a love cult, it would have been more convenient to go to Kashmir, where the women were just as white and beautiful as America's. He was up against a perfect storm of America's worst defects: media sensationalism, religious bigotry, and all the other craziness that goes on.
Crazy. But again, he was given an opportunity by a major newspaper to write a rebuttal, and he went for it. He even wrote two columns of it. So I really liked the way that Guruji went in face of adversity. He doesn't bow, he doesn't change course. He heads it right on and confronts it, which I find fantastic. So that was the story in Miami. And yeah, he had to cancel this one talk, but he moved to an undisclosed location. Maybe he had another like kind of talk there or session, we don't know. But that was like his experience in Miami. The next thing, in the film, they show a lot of newspaper articles that are pretty interesting. They're from this time. And I'm gonna read out a few. One says, "Possibility of young girls having taken lessons investigated. Printed tracts declare students learn how feelings and emotions can be drawn into brains and become spiritualized," under quotes, "by awakening the Kundalini serpent force." So I'm guessing this doesn't sound so acute. It doesn't sound like it's accusing them of anything. But there's also some articles, I guess, that are trying to explain what actually happens and what Guruji teaches. And the other one is like, a queer love cult lures many women, which is like completely made up, right? There's like no basis to this. Chris?
It's amazing how you can take things out of context. you know, and that's basically what this is, isn't it? It's I mean, apart from that last bit that you just read out there, it's not actually far away from the truth either, which is, you know, he talks about serpent force and Kundalini, but when you take things out of their context, they can sound bizarre. You know, they can sound completely bizarre. So, you know, there was talk there of how, you know, the truth was subverted and it wasn't really reported as it should have been. But yeah, it's probably not too dissimilar these days when I think about some news news that's been coming out over the years. But I suppose it's just my comment is, you know, how they can take some truth and just state it in a different way, and suddenly it becomes like, you know, it gets to the core of some people's fears and anxieties and really plays on it. It's kind of shocking to see. Really.
Yeah, absolutely. Then the next scene we see like a picture of like an open door, and there's a lady standing there. And I think she's looking back, but there's a car in front of her where she might be getting in right now. I was wondering, because it was kind of in the context of the Dhirananda story, do you think this was the lady that Dhirananda gave a private lesson to? Any guesses here in the round?
I highly doubt it. But in Phil Goldberg's biographies, she's referred to as Mrs. A.
Mrs. A? Okay.
Whatever that means. A for anonymous, perhaps.
Mrs. Anonymous. This doesn't narrow it down too much.
There's also there's a nice video in there as well of young Swami Dhirananda and Swami Yogananda. They're just like in an office and they're walking next to each other. It's quite nice footage. I don't know where they are, but that was quite nice.
Yes, that's correct. Mm. And then after we see the lady, you see a picture of Yogananda in a lecture hall. And there you can see this confirmed that like in this lecture hall, there's like, I would say 80% women in there. And I don't know where exactly that is, but it looks like Guruji is pranaming and all the other people are pranaming as well. I'm guessing they're speaking a prayer or something like this. Very nice, very nice scene. And then, the last question that is like that we can talk about now is Dhirananda. He's subsequently left Yogananda's work and did something else. He got a PhD and everything and got married, and he left the Swami order. And my question into the round is now, what do you guys think? Why did he leave Yogananda's work?
Oh. That's
go Marcus, yeah.
Why he left, that's hard to say. I mean, he was a Swami, right?
Mm.
So he had taken the vows of renunciation and they've already been together since youth, I think, at least on the spiritual path. Well, that's hard to say why he left, but apparently the pull of Maya was at some point stronger than the pull of spirituality. Maybe there was something that he felt he still had to experience besides renunciation, which is a tough call, of course.
Yeah.
We've talked about it a little before, or a little bit before, that he maybe was playing second fiddle to some of Yogananda's work when he was very involved, you know, from a young age, the two of them. And we had shared some stories in the past where Yogananda maybe would have said to Dhirananda, like, I'm going to be your guru. And that might have, you know, have had some jarring effects long term, where maybe he was playing the role of the second and wanted, it's pure speculation on my part, obviously, but he did go on to get his PhD, and he, I think, entered the field of brainwave research. I think he then went on to lecture at Harvard as well. So he was still operating at quite a high level, even in this material plane, right? So it's not like he just kind of fell off the track and went and did nothing with his life. So maybe this was simply his karma that he needed to pursue faculties that were different to spiritual plane, and possibly Yogananda may have seen this coming for some time, but who knows?
Priyan?
Yeah. I like this discussion because this the actual reason is going to be discussed in a minute 50 when that him leaving is actually takes place in the minute, so we can discuss the actual facts of that. But the fact that he got married and he started a PhD and started going into a normal everyday profession means that he was dissatisfied with the Swami order in some way. But when you take your Swami vows, those aren't usually ones which you're supposed to renege on. It's like becoming a lesson student for Yogananda, that is something that you can do with relative ease. You can try it and pop in and out, and if it works for you, it works. That's the initial stage. Becoming a Kriya, then you take that next step and you're very serious. If you're going to take Kriya, then this is your path. This is, there's nothing, you can carry on your life, but you stop looking elsewhere for God. Guruji is your light bearer. And then the one further, that is a commitment in itself, right? But then becoming a Swami or joining a monastic order, then you're leaving your life behind. So you can't really go backwards. And in SRF, there's that whole, you're a novice, then you're a brahmachari, then you're a lay. Yeah, there's three or four steps before you become a brother or a Swami. So there's many years for you to, even at that stage, to go out and this is not for you. But Swami Dhirananda's gone through all of this. He's met, no matter, can you imagine the miracles he would have seen under Swami Sri Yukteswar, let alone Guruji? He describes earlier how he basically, Swami Yogananda initiated him, and he says, only I know what Swami Yogananda has done for me. So they've gone through some pretty profound things, and for him to leave, that's a bit crazy, and then get married, it just doesn't sit well with me at all. I think slightly off topic, but Jay Shetty, he's one that kind of left, but he was a monk in training. So apparently he went to India and tried to take sannyasi or take the brahmachari vows and joined some ashram, but he didn't become a monk. Because he left, he decided, he became a lay member or whatever, how you describe it, a brahmachari, not even at that stage, and then he decided it wasn't for him. But he's got a book that says Think Like a Monk. He was never a monk, he's never a monk, so he can't claim to think like a monk because he didn't take that step. But Dhirananda is on another level, and I think there's a lot of, he's obviously quite a controversial figure because of all of this, but then there was a massive legal case between the two of them, and they really did fall out. But interestingly, Guruji still kind of spoke highly of him and praised him in the East West magazine, even after all that had happened. So we'll talk about that a bit more in minute 50.
Yeah, good point, Priyank. I think maybe with Priya, maybe with Dhirananda, the kind of structure of the different stages of his monkhood weren't in place yet. So he maybe got there faster, or maybe the vowels were different. I think when you are in SRF, once you become a monk, you don't just say you give your life to Guru this life, but also in all subsequent incarnations.
It goes even further than not even just this life.
Yeah, so it's like you don't quit anymore. But yeah, everyone is different. And it's like Marcus said, it was his karma to just fall off the track there and have a family. And he might, and maybe in his next life, feel like, okay, I've done this family thing for a last time now, so now I'll go race to the infinite as fast as I can. We don't know. Life takes us on some weird detours sometimes, right? So
yeah,
all good. So I think we wrapped up, or we covered this minute pretty well now. Unless anyone else has something to add, then I want to thank Marcus for coming on.
Marcus, yeah, it's been lovely having you. Marcus is soon to be closely related to Anna, who we had various previously. So all the best with that.
Yes, all the best.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Jai Guru.
Bye, everyone. Jai Ma.